make us think that everything is perfect, everything can be preserved and saved to the end of time. Things like that are reminders that it's a failed, physically difficult world we live in.
Hey, Dad.
Hiya, Sal.
Hi, how are you?
This is Salome, chatting to her dad, Ben. She's calling him about something that was invented in his lifetime, but is already as omnipresent as the air we breathe. Just not for Ben.
I personally tested the waters a little bit and found that it wasn't to my liking.
Ben might be an anomaly in 2017.
My experience of the internet when I've had it is that I've spent hours and hours and hours, I suddenly realised when I finished, achieving absolutely nothing. I would have been much better off going outside and mowing the lawn, feeling the grass under your feet and a bit of dirt on you and the whippersnipper kind of sticking goo all over your glasses and stuff, and getting swept by magpies. It's actually better, more real. Cyberspace is unreal.
Ben reckons the internet has taken away some of the simple pleasures in life.
Shops seem to have more and more limited stock, and if you do want to find something, like I'll travel all the way to Melbourne to go to what I thought used to be a very big record shop that would have a record in there by pure chance that I might want. And I went back to this particular record shop a few years ago, and it was tiny. It had shrunk to like a tenth the size. It used to be like a huge warehouse. But yeah, you basically had to, what they had in stock was extremely limited. But what they had in their warehouse was enormous, but you had to order it online.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me was a disappointment, because the whole idea behind it was I wanted to get a particular record, and it was an exciting adventure. I was prepared to jump on the train and travel for a day to go there and find the record and come home again. It would have been, the actual experience itself was exciting.
An echo chamber, a lifeline, a school, a playground. However you see the internet, you can't deny it's a place of light and shade. And maybe some people like it better in the real world.
I think this is what I resent about the whole thing, is the implied compulsion. But the compulsion, I resent the compulsion, but this is what you must do. There are other ways of living. People have always complained about generation gaps, but boy, this is the generation gap of all time.
This week we're talking about the old and the new, past and present, digital and analogue. I'm Samantha Groth. And you might already know that you're listening to All the Best. So the question today is, how are you listening to All the Best? Through the radio on your FM dial or streaming online? Or are you enjoying us through headphones as a digital file on our podcast? All the Best is made through digital audio recordings. It's edited with digital audio software, and then we share it in little digital audio files. I.e., I'm not real. These days, most of the stuff we watch and listen to is made digitally. It seems commonplace, but digital audio is still pretty new, and in some cases, digital is up against stiff competition. A little bit of background here. An analog piece of equipment uses electronics, motors, and various moving parts to achieve its task. In audio, recording to analog means recording to magnetic tape, half-inch tape, quarter-inch tape, or even cassette tape. Digital is different. It's bits of information, long lines of ones and zeros. Recording to digital means converting the music to ones and zeros and recording it directly into a computer. But there are still plenty of artists who prefer recording to analog. Jen Cloher song that you're listening to now was not recorded digitally. It was recorded directly to a reel-to-reel tape machine in a recording studio in rural Victoria. Some musicians have a soft spot for tape machines and analog gear. Some of them say the audio quality is different. Some of them have a lot of nostalgia and romantic ideas about tape. Daniel Simo is an audio engineer and a musician, and he wants to get to the bottom of this. Is there really that much of a difference between analog and digital? And why does it make the jobs of audio engineers and technicians a lot harder?
Well, if you look at it now in a way, you just say, what a weird way of doing things. What a weird solution to an issue and things like that. It is so hard to believe how much has changed in so short a time. Is there still an absolute merit that there is an advantage of using tape? Probably technically no. But some of my clients only want to do things on multi-track tape. They say they like the sound better. I think it's a lot of it is they don't want to overly think about things. If they're going from one track to the other or one artist to the other, it's put it on, you know, and hit play, and then push play it up and listen to it. And that's all you have to, you know, okay, now you're working. My name's Des Amos. I'm a freelance technician. I work on analog tape machines and analog consoles predominantly.
There's something to be said for just doing a recording and having it recorded and just living with however it comes out, as opposed to, you know, the digital trickery that's available.
MP3, that seems like the letters and number MP3 are just synonymous with music now. My name's Neil Thomason. I'm one of the co-owners, operators of Headgap Studio in Preston here in Melbourne. The studio's been here for 11 years, recording mainly local indie rock bands, whole bunch of other stuff as well, but that's our bread and butter, really. So this is around the time the whole sort of digital versus analog wars were really raging, because the writing was on the wall for tape, but in a purely sonic sense, it was like, oh well, you know, digital's grainy and it's, you know, two dimensional. It doesn't have any depth of field to it, and all this kind of stuff.
There are advantages in doing it that way. There's a lot of things that happen when you record to tape. It does a lot of getting rid of all nasty little thumps, spikes and stuff like that. They don't happen. There's a lot of forgiveness about using a tape machine.
Digital is definitely better if you're working on something that needs to be delivered soon, you know, like if you're working in advertising or something and there's a deadline or something. But I don't really do that too often with my music, so I'm quite happy to take my time with it. And quality over quantity anytime.
Computer has its own foibles, obviously, and they're far from flawless as well. But if I had to pick one or the other in terms of a net amount of what keeps me awake at night, you know, it's the tape machines. Well, the Studer machines are a work of art in an engineering sense. They're incredibly complex, and if you lift the lid on one, start taking off panels, having a look inside, and God forbid, try and teach yourself how to tech one to some degree, like you quickly. I mean, I could show you the manual if I could carry it in here. Like it's ridiculous. You know, it's this huge weight of paper. Tape machines to maintain can be your own personal hell, you know. You can have the whole band set up out there and the tape machine stops working properly and it's like, holy shit, you know, what do we do? And then suddenly a company comes along and says, guess what, you don't have to You don't have to run that crazy, insane, cantankerous machine in the corner over there. That's this incredible mix of mechanical and electronic stuff that's all got to work at the same time to work properly. Guess what? We've got a whole other solution here that's on a computer, and you just walk in the morning, turn on the computer and hit record. You know, like, imagine how that pitch sounded to people who were running studios at around that time. Like, it's not hard to see why digital would become popular.
Back in the days when it was relying totally on tape, it actually did require a lot more technical involvement because, you know, when you're operating tape machines for when sessions would be in there, you know, the tape machines are going, you know, 16 hours a day, things break. So I would be in studios far more often. More often than not, I'd be getting in there at, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning, making sure that everything is ready for them to start at, say, 10 or something like that. The classic one, which used to have into Ampex ATR-100 four-track tape machines, which is a particular resistor burning out. The first time I found this resistor burnt out, it took me 4 days to find it, to trace down that it was just this resistor burnt out. You just lock into, this is what I've got to do, and you just don't stop until you get to there. And that was probably one of the things of that I was better than a lot, than some others. You have to just let the particular task you're doing dictate your efforts, and that's all you're doing there. Okay, I have to fix this. How can I break this down to actually sort of do tests, to actually work out whereabouts the fault is? It is a task of actually trying to, first off, work out how can I get this studio back and earning money. I've never advertised, so it's always just word of mouth. Normally it's actually, it is about the personality of the person I'm dealing with. They've got to trust me that I'll do the best I can and I will make all efforts not to damage their gear or anything like that. I mean, they've got to trust me. They've got to have some level of trust that I am actually going to do the best thing for them. And that sort of tends to, that does determine it, because there are people that I immediately realise that they don't trust me and they are actually telling me what to do or things like that. Don't do this, or you've got to do that, and things like that. And I just have to say, sorry, I'm going. I can't work for you. Oh, there's probably lots of work, but I tend to work, I just go around to studios and work on the consoles and tape machines, or, you know, I work on site. My normal means of working is, you know, up a ladder or nestled on the floor in the middle of a hallway trying to fix something, or rather than actually taking thing to a workshop and put it on the workbench and things like that. I try to, when I do work for people, I try to give them as much information as possible. I try to teach them how to line up the tape machine, how to understand, you know, how to take apart various bits of it, because they have to be able to do that themselves. Because it is not a cost-effective exercise if you are going to pay me to come in and do everything, like change fuses and things like that. They will just send themselves broke and they'll just not get anywhere. The reason why I think a lot of people like using tape machines and analog consoles is because it is a bit of less is more. It is that you don't have all the possibilities. You have to just work with what you've got. You have to build the story as you're going along. But some people aren't. They're throwing all this data into this repository and hoping that they can then decode it into being a story at the end. And it's a really hard task. You can't even remember who the characters were anymore.
Thanks to Daniel Simo for rewinding the tape on Audio Tech, with help from supervising producer Beck Fari. This week on All the Best, we're going analogue. Our next story follows a paper trail underground. Beneath Flinders Street Station in Melbourne, there's a tiny shop run entirely by volunteers. Britta Jorgensen brings us this one, about keeping an analogue dream alive.
I guess the talk in 2001 was everyone would be buying exclusively online. We'd be all eating online. We'd all be having sex online in like 3 or 4 years, the sense was then. And so we opened the shop in 2001, and I just spent the first couple of years just handwriting letters to zine makers saying, hey, send it here, send it here. And then I guess the internet was kind of moving so fast, the sense was it was going to kill these things. But all of a sudden with the internet, everyone could hook up just really quickly. You could advertise that new zines were out. You could advertise your launch. People could buy zines online. It was really easy to get zines. And all of a sudden, the community was just flourishing because of the internet, which everyone thought was going to kill zines in the first place. But it just meant it allowed everyone to see more zines, get more zines, be influenced by more zines. And I think once people have been seeing more zines, it means they're more influenced and more people are making zines. And if more people are making zines, then even more people start to make zines. My name is Luke Sinclair and I am one of the coordinators of Sticky Institute. My definition of a zine is an independent publication. It's often photocopied. It is usually made by an individual or a small group of individuals. Usually doesn't have any advertising. If it's for sale, it's for sale at a cheap price or it's free. And it's always made for love and not for profit. But we have zines on our shelf which will break one or all of those rules. So it's a very grey area when it comes to defining what a zine actually is. There's definitely no one reason people make it. So if you start by looking at the content, some people make punk music zines, some people make poetry zines, some people make art zines, photography zines, cooking zines, and then just weirdo zines which blend all of that or none of it. So if someone has an interest which is not getting any kind of mainstream attention, then they just go ahead and do it themselves. And so that's the case for all of the things in here. And that's kind of what tends to work best in the shop as well. The kind of closer you get to any kind of content or production which could survive in a mainstream bookshop, the less our audience is going to be interested in it. So people tend to go to a bookshop if they want to buy a novel. They'll take $25 and they'll think they're going to walk out with a novel. Our audience tends to come here with $5 and they want to buy 3 or 4 things and pick up a couple of free things as well. Do you want to close that door? So there's this real kind of dilemma with where you start off making a zine and it's really scrappy, it's black and white photocopied. So then you think for issue 2, I'm going to try and step it up, might have a color cover, a little bit better production values, the content's better. And then issue 3, you think I'm going to have some color pictures inside. And then you think issue 4, I'm going to have it perfect bound. And then you think issue 5, it's going to look essentially like a professionally made novel. What we're specifically set up is to support zines. So we're pretty unapologetic about it. We'd rather that shelf space be set up with someone who's made a scrappy zine than by someone who's moved on to more of a professional project. So we're kind of in love with the more scrappier work, I guess. The best zines respect the medium and use the medium as a strength rather than a weakness. So one of the criticisms you'll see is that the print runs, very small. But you can look at that the other way, that that's actually the strength of the medium. Because if you're doing a huge print run, which is in the tens of thousands, then you can't possibly do some of the ridiculous things you can do if the print runs 100 or 200. You know, if it's a, we had a good zine called West Side Angst years ago, which issue number one came out from Adelaide. It was great. And then issue number two, the zine maker stuck actual Adelaide garbage on the cover. Because the print run's so small, you can do that. If you were doing a print run in the tens of thousands and trying to stock it in newsagents, that would just be a major, major headache. But it's not. So the print run's small. You can put lipstick on and kiss all of your zines. You can glue glitter onto every page. You can wrap it around a stick. You can wrap it around something and you can present it like that. Because the print run is so small, that means its strength in terms of what the artwork can actually be. So once you start to view it that way and accept that that is where you're making the work, then you can kind of play to those strengths, I think. Thomas, it's six. Get out of here.
Yay!
Thanks for doing all them batch bits.
Uh-huh.
That was quite a thing.
Thanks to Britta Jorgensen for that story. Cooking is such a tangible, physical thing. All that chopping, stirring, bashing pots and pans. It's hard to think about a digital kitchen. But what about the instruction manual? In this next story, Samara Barr flips through her mum's analog recipe collection and cleans up the mess of paper scraps.
Growing up, I associated my mum with the smell of cooking. I always looked forward to coming home after a long day of school and trying to guess what was for dinner based on the delicious smells wafting out from the kitchen. Her amazing lasagna, spicy Rogan Josh, or hearty beef stroganoff. Mum has loved cooking pretty much her whole life.
I got my first recipe book when I was in high school. I think I was probably in grade 10 or so, and Omar bought me a book. And I do recall it was called the Cooking Class Cookbook. So it was quite complicated. It was a European cookbook.
It makes sense that Mum's first recipe book was European, as her mum, my Omar, is German. Sleepovers at Omar's meant lots of steaming stews and thick buttery pancakes for breakfast.
Oh yeah, there was a lot of German influence. It generally just, it was just things that we sort of, as the Australian palate doesn't get. It had all the salt, all the fish that were the European fish and how to cook them and just different things to what we would normally eat in Australia. But it was still a really interesting cookbook and I still have it today. But I didn't actually start collecting cookbooks or doing anything with them until I left home and I had to cook for myself. And that was when I started experimenting with food and recipes and things like that.
Mum's cookbook was a kitchen staple as we grew up. It was her Bible. I distinctly remember its burgundy tattered cover and the worn pages yellow from age, with occasional splatters after a few close calls. Anytime we wanted Omar's pancakes, we consulted the book.
Oh, well, I just had a little exercise book and I used to write recipes in it and cut recipes out of magazines and glue them in. So anything that I made that I liked that was working, I would stick in it and I would get recipes from friends and put them in it. And it just grew over the years. So I still add to it today.
I still call my mum pretty regularly for advice in the kitchen. Mum's recipe collection is vast, spanning continents and cultures.
I have an eclectic collection of cookbooks because I started buying cookbooks from every country I visited. So when your father and I were travelling, we would buy a cookbook from every country. So I have cookbooks from all over the world.
But my recipe collection consists of my phone and the internet. If I don't call my mum to consult her collection, I can just search for any recipe I can think of.
I think maybe books for your generation are going out, I don't know. Certainly for me, I would never ever trade my books, my cookbooks, they're very special to me. But maybe it's something that you don't need, I don't know. It depends whether you like the idea of having something that you can hang on to and read it, or whether you're just happy to sit with your computer or your phone or your iPad, whatever, and look at your own eclectic collection that you gather over the years.
I cook using my iPad, and as I'm not the cleanest or neatest cook, it often ends up splattered with whatever I'm making that night. I can just wipe it off clean. Mess and memory taken away forever. However, Mum's book holds on to the sense, leaving a physical reminder of meals past. And that's why Mum's very own handwritten cookbook is her favourite. But with much love, it started looking a bit worse for wear, and I was worried it might fall apart. As a birthday present, I secretly stole the recipe book each night after Mum had gone to bed and typed up each recipe. On her birthday, I gifted it to her in a new folder. It wasn't the same, but she didn't seem to mind.
It actually needs updating, Samara, because I've stuck lots of things in it and little scrappy pieces of paper that I've written things, you know, down on quickly. And I often get recipes off the TV and scrawl them down in terrible handwriting, and then I never rewrite them neatly. They just go in, you know, on a scrappy piece of paper or into it. I've also been known to write recipes out and doctor surgeries out of magazines, and they go in on little teared up bits of paper too. So, you know, it's just a beautiful mess. I love going back to my old favourite recipes in my cookbooks, and, you know, my problem is I have so many cookbooks, sometimes I can't remember which cookbook exactly the recipe I'm looking for is in, so that's time consuming. The internet's handy, like I said, when you need to fill in the gap quickly, you can just Google something to find what you want to use. So, it, you know, they both have their place. Though I would never replace my cookbooks, I would never get rid of my cookbooks to use the internet solely. I think, you know, I add internet recipes to my cookbook because sometimes I find really nice recipes on the internet that are interesting and fun, and I want to make them again. So I print them out and stick them in. A drawback for your father is he makes lovely recipes on the internet and he never prints them out, and when he goes back months later to make the same thing again, he can't find the recipe and it's gone forever.
While the internet is a slippery little sucker, Mum thinks there's a way to utilise the digital world to fix this problem.
For all you computer savvy younger people, you'd probably do better off with starting your own cookbook folder on your computer and just adding recipes into that as you find them. And, you know, when you go out places, you can add recipes and photographs of food and take photographs of food you've made and put it in with the recipe, and anything that takes your fancy you could add to your cookbook folder and probably make it a lot more interesting and meaningful than mine. I don't have photographs of the people, the recipes I got, so maybe, you know, you can take photographs of your friends and the wonderful recipe they made and the recipe and put it all together to make a, you know, a live story that you can, you know, go back to and look at again and again. So, you know, if you can collect that for the next, you know, 50 years of your life, you'll have a wonderful memory to look back on. Like, I look back at my cookbooks all the time, and they have special meaning to me. They're not just recipe books, they're moments in my life that, you know, food's always been a part of our life, and both Dad and I love cooking, and our cookbooks probably reflect that in that they're special to us.
Recipes are more than a set of instructions for my family.
Oh, I think cooking brings people together, and as you know, we've always had lots of people around and dinner parties and stuff, and having a good collection of cookbooks or a good collection on your computer of recipes that you love is a wonderful thing to have and keep forever, and it just can just keep growing till the day you die.
Thanks to Samara Barr and her mum, Alona, for that delicious story with editing help from Beck Fari. And thanks to Salome Lyons Morrison from our top story, chatting to her dad, Ben Lyons, about getting offline and getting things done IRL. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producers are Selena Shannon and Beck Fari. Our community coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Beth Gibson is our SYN production manager. Tegan Nichols compiles our show. And I'm your host, Samantha Groth. And thanks to all our contributors this week for your retro tech. Our artwork is designed by Annie Hamilton, and our theme music is composed by Shining Bird. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And did you know you can find all our archives? That means all our previous episodes at allthebestradio.com. Luckily, we do live in the digital world, so you can also subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcast app.